Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
We have some new faces tonight. Very nice to see you. We should do introductions around.
Wendy.
Yes.
Rita.
Violet.
Nestor.
Russ. Jeffrey.
Corinne.
Judy.
Mary.
Mary. Mary, you've been here before.
Been here last year,
summertime.
I'm from New York.
That's right. Welcome home.
Oh, thank you. Good memory.
And you're new. Yes. How did you hear about us?
I find you online.
Of course. Yes. Well, you're very welcome. It must be a little confusing, but it's pretty simple. So, yeah. And Max is here from the university. And I was hoping that you would explain your presence.
Yeah, so as part of the course I'm taking, we are doing an ethnographic study, which is essentially just observing any form of group of people and being a participant observer, so taking part in whatever cultural actions and behaviors they are taking part in, trying to observe and trying to kind of internalize it, and then at the end be able to record that I observed. So thank you for allowing me to be here. And
so can we read it when you're done?
If you'd like to see the finished copy.
I like that.
Absolutely.
At my beginning religion. So, yeah, so we were supposed to pick a group with a religious aspect to it.
What's your major?
Science.
Science. Yeah, I thought so.
A little bit out of my element.
Well, this would be really interesting. Well, we have a study every evening. At the moment, we are reading this book, which is called Each Moment is the Universe. It's a collection of talks that Katagiri Roshi, who was contemporary with my teacher. He began as my teacher did at San Francisco Zen Center, was brought over by Suzuki Roshi to help establish Zen in San Francisco, and then went off to Minnesota after it was all developed and morphed into what it is now, basically, and created his own Zen Center and gave very wonderful talks for many, many years before he passed away. So this is a collection. It's somewhat about time and space, somewhat about the universe, but mostly it's about basic Zen practice and an encouragement to practice, not to be discouraged and to try to understand it as best we can. There are many theories about the mind, about consciousness, even far, far back in Buddhist times. And he attempts to talk about that, especially in terms of our understanding of the self, of what it is to be somebody, what it is to be a human being. And being itself, we wake up in a little bed as babies, and we are. But the experience of it continues as a kind of mystery, that we don't really know what this is. And then we create art. We don't create, but relationships are created by our experience with things. And everything that we experience becomes a part of our world experience, which makes each one of us very different from each other in many ways, because each one has somewhat different experience through our upbringing and the way our bodies are comported and how our mind is liking math more than English or something like that. So it tries to, in Zen, we try to explain this in various ways. And last week we talked, week before last, we talked about Alaya Vijnana, which is one kind of mysterious way of trying to explain this being that has eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and a body that takes in various ways through all our sensitivities, a world. And each of us is a world at the same time. And that if we begin to study that experience and really begin to deeply experience it, that we begin to understand the tenuousness of our living in life and also the depth of it and the profundity of our connection with everything completely. So this is one way of describing. And I don't know, I passed out Coben's teaching about it last time, and I don't know if there are any questions based on his words. I looked for them this evening and I have lost them.
I brought mine.
Good.
So would you like it?
I just thought if there were any questions based on that, that
comments maybe.
Comments, yes. Please, comment.
Let me get right to it then. So, I found this page. This is a little bit like why we're different.
Mm-hmm.
He's talking about, so even though I was interested in French, I couldn't be a Frenchman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of us who came to Zen, at least for my part, I tried to be Japanese, but I couldn't. The transmitted qualities of our ancestors, their blood, their body structure, are also in the seventh sense. Our history is also in the seventh sense. It includes all cultural activity, the kind of car we drive, etc. That is really profound, and it was so, for me, reassuring that I haven't wasted a lot of my time. Those things are, you know, deeply interesting to me, and also a commitment I've made in my life to study those things. And so I've never seen that ever in anything I've read. So reading just that paragraph was deeply, profoundly like, aha!
It sort of makes everything okay, right?
Well, you know, some people hesitate to study their history.
Yes.
Their personal history, which of course is their family. And if you know anything about your lineage or who you come from and who those people came from. And of course, it goes back into a point where it's all a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
And we hear that mystery. We're profoundly affected by that mystery.
Yes.
Where do we come from? And then how it's played out right in this moment. All of that And we frequently experience this when we get together for Christmases or Thanksgivings, and we look across the table at a sister or an uncle or a father or a nephew, and you see those things that you're connected to, obviously. You know, maybe the way the child laughs, he laughs just like you. Maybe he has the same kind of, you know, I don't know, he does things that are exactly like him. And then he's so different. He's his own.
Yeah.
As somebody who spent 20 years, well, 30 now, 32 years working with young people, they come in already with certain qualities, characteristics that you can see after you've spent any time talking with their parents.
Yes.
So, but for me, what was so amazing about this was that whole idea of that these embracements are what we are going to experience samsara or nirvana. We are either going to, you know, walk a path of suffering, and we're going to get some clarity and not suffer as much.
In the same way.
In the same way.
Yes.
This was,
thank
this
you,
was
Jeffrey.
Thank you so much for that.
Thank you. Anybody else? Leslie?
Well, what Jeffrey said, and you said earlier, brought to mind something I heard on This American Life, a story. And at the very end, one of the people said, it was about a family tragedy that had a kidnapping or a lost child, and the granddaughter of that person was telling, and it involved three different families, and the people in whose lineage the sort of wrongfully accused people at the end of the day said, one man said, I can't hate the past because it would mean I hate myself. And it just, you know, kind of in the way that passage struck Jeffrey, the truth of that, how everything comes into this moment.
Yes, and it's ours.
And also his turning away from hatred was, I think, amazing. When the whole story is very complex, but you know, his rejection of hating that experience that his family had, and choosing, you know, here I am.
It does perfectly. Yeah. Oh, thank you. You'd say we carry it, but it carries us at the same time, all of this. It's not a personal thing, really. It's just how it happens. It's always happening. And we're always a part of the activity of it. It means that when things happen, we don't have to take it personally. That it can be just one more darn thing. You know, sometimes it's not great, but it can be kind of fascinating to think, I thought I was going to do this, and all of a sudden I have to do that because things happen. And that's a wonderful example. Yeah. I and not hate it. No point. Just hating my own life and experience. That's no point at all. So in this book, he goes on to talk about nirvana. So he's going into, at the end of this book, he's going into sort of gnarly subjects that are not as simple as talking about how to sit. But of course, it's all about sitting. He also tends to start talking, or maybe the translator, or the one who arranged this all is responsible for some of it. He begins to talk about a lot of shoulds. You should do this, and that there's a final goal. He calls nirvana a final goal. Well, this is a very ancient Buddhist understanding of practice, that you practice really, really hard until you transcend your life completely, cross over, they say, to the other shore. And then you're no longer tied up in the suffering of being a human being, that you've transcended. Well, Buddha's understanding in the very beginning, on which this is based, was not that. So they took Buddha's teaching and jolted it into this other aspect. What Buddha did was to look deeply into his own life, just the things that we were talking about, as he sat under the tree and saw that. Saw and accepted his life and nature, the things that came to him, his hubris. He was offered to be the king of the world. He was offered to have all the money he ever needed. He was offered everything that we ever dream as human beings, and he saw that that's what he wanted. He wanted all those things, and that all of that was not it. That whatever he was looking for, that wasn't it. And so finally, he simply saw through all of that in himself and stopped trying to be the king of himself and the king of the world. And in the end, he looked up and saw a star, and he totally connected with the star, just as you would connect with something as you walk out in a kind of dream. Oh, that star is in me. That star is me. And that star is everything else. And then the story goes on to say that the gods got mad at him and said, "What gives you the right to do this? What gives you the right to actually even see such a thing?" And he touches the earth, and he says, "The earth gives me the right. The earth does." And you'll see many statues of Buddha with his hand touching the ground. It's not about heavenly transcendence, it's about being right here, right now, and letting that be enough, and letting us, just as we are, be enough. And mysteriously, that is the truth of nirvana, of seeing through and embracing our life as it is. So Katagiri says, Nirvana is not enlightenment. It's everyday life based on wisdom. So, once we know ourselves well and accept it and learn how to work with it, it becomes naturally wise. We become naturally wise. And he says, standing in the realm of wisdom and seeing the truth, we think deeply, how can I build up everyday life? How can I do something to make this better? He says this is called arousing the Bodhi mind, and Bodhi mind just means enlightenment mind. But we have such funny ideas about enlightenment that it's some big blast of golden light and perfection, and it's not that at all. It's just coming to back to the earth and to the moment and to actual being as we are right now, right here. But it also means, as he says, taking a vow to save all sentient beings before thinking of ourselves. Saving all sentient beings is a very complicated sounding thing, and it sounds like we're elevating ourselves and looking down on all the poor sods who don't study Zen. That's not it. I always say I vow to be with all things. It's just to recognize how entirely connected we are with each of everyone. And everyone is our world. So once we begin to really see our life, we have to see others. And to begin to understand not only our own suffering, but other people's too. And to feel for others. That's the other side of wisdom, is compassion. So he makes a very important point about Bodhi mind, that it's alive in everyday life. It's not some special attitude. It's just being awake and aware in everyday life. Really looking, listening, paying attention. But he said it leads you to forget your self-consciousness. Practice leads you to forget your self-consciousness. And where there's no self-consciousness, it's called enlightenment. So that's kind of easy in a way. We often are so aware of how other people are thinking, or how we think other people are thinking about us. And it's a very silly thing, because we don't know. We really don't know. We will never know. We don't even know what we are like to our own self, because we never see ourselves except in a mirror. Never. We can see a hand or a foot, but we can't see ourselves altogether, ever. It's kind of weird. Nobody can read our mind, and we can't read anybody else's mind. I know how many times I've crept through the world thinking, oh, what do they think about me? This is terrible. I'm such a bad person. And probably people are thinking about themselves, almost always. So this whole business of self-consciousness is really useless. We don't need it in order to do what we need to do. It's easy just to forget. Just like when we speak, I always think it's the best example. We don't usually, and it's a lot more cogent to avoid it, is just to speak and let the words come out. If you plan every single word, no, you don't plan every single word. It would be terrible. You would have to write it all out and then read it off. And we don't do that. We just allow what we say not to be ourself, because we don't know what that is anyway. We just enact it. We're acting through the life force in our body and mind. We're part of the life force of everything that's going on, of the trees and the grass. And we are lucky we can speak. So he says, continuous practice is the way without beginning or end. It means to go without stopping at all, not even for a moment. It's a very refined action, a pure and clear nature of pure and clear nature of human action. So really, in the end, this whole practice is about action. Although we try to express it in ideas, what we do is sit. Sometimes we bow. Sometimes we stand and walk. Sometimes we wash the dishes and cook the dinner. Sometimes we diaper the baby. That's all practice. Every bit. Everything that we can do. And do with the mind of wisdom and compassion. So are there questions? We have a few minutes for questions. Comments? Ross.
Good to see you back.
Thank you.
Remember all of the words. I was curious if you could also say, instead of everything is action, that there's a sense of being from which everything is action.
Where would that be?
Well, in the sense that, the sense of beingness is, and then we act. I mean, it seems like they're somewhat related, right?
Well, we see what we do in retrospect, and then we say, I did that. But really, it's hard to claim it. If you talk to an actor or a writer, they will say, these things come to me. It comes and I do it. So, it's... I know what you mean. It's just very hard to say. There isn't any other where.
Yeah, I was just thinking that in some ways, what's more fun, like say I lift my hand, that's action. But it seems like even more basic is that I can sense my hand and there's a sense of something there which seems somehow more primal or something, before the action.
about that. I don't know what to say about that.
But
yeah,
I was just curious.
Yeah, thank you. I love having something to think about. Yeah, experience, the experience of feeling something, and then we identify it, and then we call it mine. But the actual basic experience is selfless. And then we make it ourself. So there's an extra step in there somewhere of the way the mind works to grasp it and hold it as mine. Even though it's really not even mine, we don't own our body. It was given. And then we have the wonderful opportunity to enact it. So it's kind of complicated. Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Well, thank you all for holding the fort while I was gone. It could have been horrible, and it wasn't. So I was in a car crash 5 blocks from my house that totaled my car and mashed me up a little bit, but I'm fine now. So thank you for being so worried. I'm really sorry. I tried not to make a big deal out of it, but since it wasn't a big deal. Back in the hospital, the doctor chewed me out. She said, "You're old. You should get rid of your keys. Old people shouldn't be driving cars." And I tried to tell her it wasn't my fault. I didn't do anything. A young person just whammed into me. So, just the way things are. Yes, Mary.
So, I'm so happy you recovered. So,
thank you.
Talking about everyday Zen, you know. Yeah, I like what you're sharing because we always try to separate ourselves. Like when we are sitting, we try to be on the cushion to struggle to reaching awakening stage. Then we go to the real work and we forgot about everything.
Yeah.
We become a totally stressful, emotional. And but this remind us every day, every work we do, every action we take, we have to use this kind of a Zen mind.
That's
and,
it.
Maybe breathing, you know.
Yes.
And just be aware of every action. Try not to separate ourselves,
mm-hmm.
as when we practice in Zen.
Yeah.
So if we do that, correct me if I'm wrong. If we do that, if we maintain that attitude, as the book talk about, we may be able to have less judgment,
mm-hmm.
about everything. So we kind of devoting ourselves, contributing ourselves to the world, because we are all connected. And when we have no separation, and I think everything may be easier for us.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Excellent point. Excellent point. Judgment gets way in the way, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because every time, you know, people tend to have judgment all the time. When
yes.
they see new people, immediately in your head you will say, what kind of person is this?
Yes.
Does he drinking or does he whatever? You're creating a
story.
Yeah, story about that person. Interesting part, I went to a sesshin one, it's a 7-day sesshin. So at the beginning, I did not go first day. So I went there second day. So it's a whole silent for the next 6 days. So there's over 50 people there. So in my mind, because of 6 days no talking, so I try to, you know, say this person might be this person might be that. So by the end, after the end of the session, we'd be able to talk. I found that whatever I projected is all wrong anyway. You know what I mean?
There are many stories about retreats where people in a group like that fall in love with somebody across the room.
Really?
Completely, just passionately in love. And then finally, when they can talk, ooh. Well, both are very, very helpful. If you're developing your Zen practice in silence, your mind goes through many, many different convolutions. And because you can't turn on the TV or jump in the car and go somewhere, you're just stuck on the cushion. You have to see it. You have to see what you're doing. So if you're falling in love with somebody across the way, you have to see that that's what you're doing. But then when you can verify, you can check it out because you're able to talk. And you can see how crazy your mind really is. It just does projection, as Mary says. You're just projecting all the time. Thinking you know, instead of just stopping and saying, asking, what is this now? What is this in front of me? How can I understand this? And meet it as honestly and as openly as you can. That's pretty hard to do because we're afraid of each other. There's a lot of fear, and fear goes into the projection that we make also. So finding ways of being with our fear and understanding it more deeply. Actually, I was just told the other day that some people think that fear and anger are brother and sister to each other. Mm-hmm. And if you're afraid, you're really angry. And if you're angry, you're really afraid. Interesting to think about that. So it's a little after 8, we should stop, but thank you all very much. We'll have a 1-minute sit.
Right.